Today's holiday episode of Socially Democratic is presented to you by Dun Street. Dun Street is a progressive campaign agency that specializes in campaigning and community organizing. We work with nonprofit and community-based organizations, trade unions, progressive businesses, and social democratic parties across the globe. Dun Street develops community engagement and organizing strategies to win campaigns both big and small. We train engagement staff, volunteers, and organizers in leadership and power building, and we help leaders craft their own public narrative that tells a story that unites people and moves them to act together. And if you want to create change in your community, then hit us up at dunstreet.com.au. And today's episode is brought to you by Maurice Blackburn Lawyers. Maurice Blackburn have a Melbourne-based opportunity for an experienced social media and communications professional to support their marketing and employment and industrial relations law teams. If you are highly creative, a technical specialist with strong stakeholder and relationship management skills, then Maurice Blackburn want to hear from you. The campaigns and communications specialist is responsible for executing the social media content plan, largely supporting the employment and industrial law team, but will also have exposure to other areas of the firm. The successful candidate will develop and implement content that will drive traffic and engagement to Maurice Blackburn's practice areas to ensure that the practices remains a leading voice on social media. This is a great job opportunity and will ideally suit an established progressive campaigner looking for a new opportunity in a great professional environment. To find out more about the job board, the details and all that kind of stuff, just go to morrisblackburn.com.au/careers. That's morrisblackburn.com.au/careers. And finally, today's episode is brought to you by SwiftFox. Every moment on a campaign matters. You need the tools that you can trust, lists that are up to date, phone banks that can change minds, emails that drive donations, events that will energize the community both online and offline, and text blasts that distill your message perfectly. SwiftFox CRM is made for campaigners by campaigners. And to find out more, simply go to their website, which is swiftfoxcrm.com, to win your next campaign. Hello and welcome to another episode of Socially Democratic, your weekly centre-left politics and organising podcast that drops every Friday, that dives into the progressive campaigns of the day and the people leading them from home and abroad, which is not what we're about to talk about because it's our sort of our in-between Christmas and New Year episode, our wedge episode, where I get my good friend on the line, Tess Farrell, who we're going to talk about pop culture because we all know that you're probably on holiday at the beach or taking a break or at the cricket or doing something. There's not a lot happening right now. So we normally just sort of chew the fat about what we watched this year that has kind of a political bent or some kind of, you know, current affairs or newsworthy or social justice-y type of TV or film. So Tess Farrell comes on every year and we just basically review what we've watched that you might be interested in watching, and we tend to not do spoilers, but if we do, we'll let you know. So looking forward to having a chat today to find out what Tess watched in 2023 and what I watched and do a bit of a review. And if you like the show, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts, and please give us 5 stars or leave us a review. And for a good one, obviously. And for all the updates, please follow Dun Street on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. All right, let's get to today's special podcast pop culture review episode. We are taping this one on a Tuesday evening on the lands of the Wurundjeri people. And this is our annual pop culture end of year review episode, and it's we usually try and drop it between Christmas and New Year, and because it's a bit more lighter content than the traditional topics and conversations that we have for Socially Democratic. And once again, for I think the third or fourth year running, to help me break down the TV shows or the movies that we think you should maybe watch whilst you're at the Cape Patterson Caravan Park, is my good friend and I guess our pop culture correspondent, Tess Farrell. Welcome back to Socially Democratic.
Thank you, Stephen. I'm happy to be here. I love this time of year where I go back to the list of things I've been watching and realise that I really need to get a life because I've watched way too much. TV and way too many movies this year, but I'm excited to chat through the highlights of the year.
Excellent. Have you found in 2023 that, I mean, I know it's the, it can be the case every year you sort of think back and go, oh, what did I watch this year? But I feel like this year was even more kind of difficult to think about what, because just because of the overhang from COVID, like that, when we did it in the COVID years, that 2020, 2021 period, we were kind of like, oh, all these years have all blurred into one. But there's like a hangover from that where I actually had to go, did we watch Succession this year or was that last year? Or, and there were some other TV shows that took forever to then come out again and do the follow-up episode, the follow-up season, like Loki, for example. It's been 2 years since Loki came out.
Yeah, there was a lot of that and a lot of winding up of long-running shows. So when that happens, it's like, when did this start? When did it end? Like Succession, like Ted Lasso. So it is hard to distinguish, but I felt like there weren't a lot of groundbreaking new shows this year, but there was a lot of content to consume. A lot of sports, a lot of Beckham.
Yes, Kelsey. Absolutely. But a lot of crossover, right?
Yeah, a lot of crossover. It's been another big year in content.
It has. So what we're going to do is we're going to break the episode up into three parts. Part one is we are going to review the film Rustin. Part two, we're going to review the film Barbie. And then part three, Tess is going to run through a number of her, I guess, sort of, we're just going to have a quick fire run through. I say quick fire, I'll probably turn it into like a 40-minute conversation. All the shows that you enjoyed throughout 2023 and have a bit of a conversation. So almost like a Tessa's sort of summer recommendations, I guess we could call it. I'm sure we have a name for it. I can't remember now. I think I did have a name, didn't I? Where is it? Where's my run sheet? Yeah, Tessa's other summer recommendations. I knew we had a name for it. So that's what we're going to do.
Very creative.
Isn't it? Very creative. Very, very instructive. That's what we like. Okay, so no spoilers for Rustin, but maybe some spoilers, but we'll certainly give you pre-warning as we move through when we do Barbie in part two. So let's get underway, shall we?
Starting with
Rustin. So some of the basic facts. Rustin is what was released this year, 2023, American biographical drama film directed by George C. Wolfe. And the screenplay was by Julian Breese and Dustin Lance Black. And it's a story about the life of a civil rights activist in the 1960s by the name of Bayard Rustin, hence the film is named after the protagonist in the show. It's actually produced by Barack and Michelle Obama's production company, Higher Ground, which was interesting to note. And I wonder what other productions will come from this work, because this was very interesting and obviously clearly something that was dear to the hearts of both Michelle and Barack. And the film stars Colman Domingo in the title role, and his background is mostly from Broadway and the London's West End, but folks may also know him from this TV series Euphoria, and starred alongside a whole bunch of other folks, which we'll get to in a moment. And it's based on the true story of Bayard Rustin, who was a civil rights activist and a community organizer that helped Martin Luther King Jr. and others to organize the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom in 1963. And for those of you that don't know what that march was, it is the march that where Martin Luther King gave his I Have a Dream speech. And it's currently streaming on Netflix. Quick question to you, Tess. Had you ever heard of Mr. Rustin before this film?
A little bit shamefully, no, I had not. So I didn't know his story at all. So it was all new to me. And that was one really great aspect of the film, how they dived in to capture this moment in history about someone I had no idea of. So it was great.
And I think that's part of the point, right, is that we know about most people listening to this podcast will know about the I Have a Dream speech. I think you'd have to be Born on Another Planet, if you weren't aware of one of the most famous speeches given in the 20th century. And I think a lot of people would know about the March on Washington upon which the speech was made, but certainly I don't think many people would have known about the person that organized the march itself. I didn't know about Bayard Rustin myself. And I
really?
No.
That surprises me.
Well, I know I didn't. And I did. I was fortunate enough when I went back to university as an adult to get my degree at La Trobe University. I did a full year of – there was a subject on African-American civil rights, and I regard myself as reasonably well-read on this subject matter, and I had never heard of him. So I was like, wow, okay, this is great. But I guess that's the story of, you know, good organizers. They shouldn't be up front. They should be at the back doing all the work, making sure it all happens. And that's kind of what the story is really about. So let's – sorry, you know, about to say something there.
No, I was just going to say, yeah, that's, you're right. It's great to learn more of the story from someone who is really in there organizing, and to have those really historical figures like Martin Luther King be sort of just second side characters in the film, and just like, oh, that's Martin Luther King, but not be the central main character. It was very fascinating.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about the plot, shall we? So as I said before, it tells the story of this very charismatic community organizer, Bayard Rustin, who had been around for quite some time. And it is centered around, I guess, the plot sort of begins introducing him and his work in the late 1950s, organizing the elements of the civil rights movement with Martin Luther King, who was in, I guess, his embryonic stages as a leader as well. But Rustin is confronted with homophobia within the civil rights movement. He is an openly gay man. And because of that, leaders within the civil rights movement don't want him essentially around. And so he sort of takes, he has a, I guess you'd call a sabbatical. He takes a bit of a back seat, but then is brought back into this moment in 1963, despite incredible odds and forces trying to prevail against him. He manages to organize the March on Washington in 1963. And obviously this event is considered one of the high points of the civil rights movement in the United States, where over 200,000 people gathered in front of the Lincoln Memorial on the National Mall in Washington, D.C., which is also this historically where Forrest Gump told Jenny that he loved her. but at this rally, at this event, the speakers, they call for the end of racial discrimination in the United States, and it's where Martin Luther King gave his famous I Have a Dream speech. So I'm going to change it around a bit, because I want to talk about the themes of the movie, and normally we do that first, but actually I'm going to mix it up, Tess, because I actually want to talk about the characters first, because I think it's better to sort of set the scene in terms of who's in this in and around the time before we then move into the thematics of the plot, if you'll allow me. Because you said before, there are a lot of characters in this show, and Rustin is the central character in this movie, and we pass through so many other folks that are actively involved in the civil rights movement at this time. But let's start with Bayard Rustin, who's played by Colman Domingo. Have you seen him in any other performances? I've never seen Euphoria, but I'm wondering from you, was he an important character in the TV series of Euphoria?
I have seen Euphoria, and it's a disturbing show to me. Don't let your teenagers watch it, anyone who has teenagers that are listening. But I didn't recognize him because his character is quite different. He kind of plays a recovering drug addict in Euphoria, and his hair's shorter and he wears a beanie. So I didn't recognize him immediately, but it's not surprising to me to hear that he did a lot of Broadway, because his presence is just, it's so emotive, like his facial expressions. And I thought he was fantastic, a fantastic actor to play Rustin.
So the character Rustin, the real life character, obviously was, as I said before, was an African American leader in the civil rights movement. He came through it via the Socialist Party in the United States. He was an avid socialist to begin with. He then learned about the practice of nonviolence as a form of campaigning from Gandhi. Not Gandhi directly, I think Gandhi had already been assassinated, but he travelled to India and learned about the movement of nonviolence. And obviously he was a gay rights activist, certainly much more in his later life. He worked with a guy by the name of A. Philip Randolph on the march, on the campaign to organise the march on Washington, and he met Randolph through his earlier career. Rustin had organized the Freedom Rides, which was trying to break segregation on the national bus lines that took folks from the non-segregated North into the segregated South, where Jim Crow was prevalent. And so he played a big role in the Freedom Rides, which was very, very important in the late 1950s. He helped organize the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which essentially was elevated Dr. Martin Luther King and his leadership. He taught King about nonviolence. And then obviously we then meet him as he is beginning to play a role in the organizing of this particular march on Washington for jobs and freedom. Want to get your thoughts on you've talked a little bit about his performance in the film. What was it that stood out to you about why he was such a great character, or why Common Domingo's performance of Rustin was so important?
I just thought the expression on his face, they did quite a lot of sort of zoomed in shots of his, you know, just his face throughout the film. And he didn't have to say anything at all for you to know exactly how he was feeling. And I really, really enjoyed that. I thought it was fantastic. And I think it's kind of tackling a lot of things, right? You've got civil rights movement. You've got, well, I guess the gay rights movement wasn't really happening. It was all in secret. There was a lot of different layers to the film. Mm. And for him to be able to move between the two, between his personal life and sort of his working life, I thought, you know, that was a great element of the film.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll talk about that in a moment. I actually want to get your reflections on that. Amal Amin played Martin Luther King. I don't think I need to explain to folks who Martin Luther King is, but obviously a very young Martin Luther King in this film. Glyn Turman played A. Philip Randolph. For folks who are wondering who Mr. Randolph is, his background actually comes from the labor movement, as I would say, in the US or the trade union movement here in Australia. He basically was the person that created the very first union for black workers, and it was the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, because all of the workers that worked in on the train lines where there were sleeping cars were all African American men. And Philip Randolph came from a union background, and he was instrumental in actually organizing the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. He then was brought into the as a co-leader for the Montgomery bus boycott. And if we know our civil rights history, this is the campaign that we all remember when Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat on a bus in the town of Montgomery, Alabama. And that campaign in 1955 and 1956 sought to desegregate the bus lines in Montgomery, Alabama. And he was one of the co-leaders along with Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks and Reverend Abernathy and a number of others. But he was crucial because he was an organizer. That's what he brought to that work, and that's what he was bringing to this march. So he was a very, very important character in this story. Chris Rock turns up and plays Roy Wilkins. Roy Wilkins was the executive secretary at the time and went on to be the executive president of the NAACP, which is the – I always have to try and remember this and not get confused with the U.S. sports organization, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. And the NAACP was seen as a biracial organization that was founded in the early 1900s to advance the rights of African American men and women. He was seen as quite a moderate activist. He had a Chris Rock's character, Roy Wilkins, was he always sought change through legislative means. That was important to the plot and the tension within this particular story. He was always suspicious of the communist influence within the grassroots movement amongst the African American community, and was portrayed in this film as a rival to Rustin. What did you think about Chris Rock's character, or his sort of? People said he was Some people have criticized him by saying he was miscast. I don't know where they're coming from. I thought he played the role quite well.
Miscast. I just couldn't get. It took me about an hour for me to adjust to see Chris Rock in a serious role. I didn't have time to look it up, but I did want to know whether or not he has played a dramatic role before, because this wasn't comedy in any way. So I did find that a little bit distracting. You know, I'd be talking about serious stuff and Chris Rock would appear and it would kind of break for me. but I thought, you know, all in all, he did, like portraying him, he did a good job.
It follows that long list of comedians who have gone into those serious dramatic roles, right? Will Ferrell, Adam Sandler, Jim Carrey. And all of a sudden now we have Chris Rock doing it as well.
Yeah, maybe it was the slap from Will Smith that that sent him into a new dimension. And here we are in 2023, serious yes. Chris Rock.
That's right. Go and think about himself. What I need to do something different now. This is stand up at the Oscars isn't working for me. And then the other person I just want to draw attention, and as I said before, there is a lot of cast members in this, so it could take forever. Mm. But Gus Harper plays the role of a guy by the name of Tom Kahn, who is a young white activist. Civil rights activist who happens to be white, and was mentored by Rustin and has a on-again, off-again relationship with Rustin. Are there any other sort of characters or people that you wanted to lift up yourself that I may have missed?
No, those were the key characters.
It's very male-dominated, I must admit. There are women in this show, but obviously the civil rights, Coretta Scott King appears. I mean, there's just so many characters that sort of slip in and out. Like John Lewis appears.
A moment where one of the female organizers says, "There are no women here. I want out," which I found really interesting. But yes, all the lead them out.
I mean, that was the challenge, right? It was a very male-dominated movement. I mean, not to say there weren't women there, but the leadership was heavily male-dominated. I think it was difficult for African-American women to step up into those roles and say, "Hey, I want to take charge of this," right?
All the males in the room were making all of the decisions, and funnily enough, all the women were doing sort of the grunt work, you know, the calling, the getting people on buses to come to the marches. Which for too long is probably how it's always been.
Yeah. And I think to your point, that character, I can't remember who the character was that said that, but that, I mean, that was kind of naming it, wasn't it, for us to say, if we were sitting there watching, going, "Where are the main female leads in this show?" That was them naming it and saying, "Well, that's half the problem, isn't it, that what's going on here?"
Mm.
Let's talk about some of the themes, because you started to scratch the surface before. And I think that going into this, you'd think, okay, the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom was about African-American men and women staking a claim to say to the powers, the white powers in US politics, that we want social change, we want civil rights for in the employment space, but even more than that. But yet it really isn't a story of black versus white, but more about the internals within the movement itself. And I think that was interesting. There are moments where Rustin is having an argument with sort of the head of the police, who's being a prick about what they can and can't do at the march itself. But really, there isn't a lot of confrontation or disagreement between the civil rights movement on one hand and then the powers that be, which is essentially the Kennedy administration in 1963. Mm. I mean, is that how you saw it?
Totally. And when I was watching it, I thought of you immediately. Kind of just, I guess you and I both, you more so, but worked around organizing space for a long time. And just those meetings in those rooms where you've got everyone's competing opinions, you know, the activists, the unionists, the men, the women, and everyone sort of wants to do something differently. And I found those parts really, really relatable.
Oh, and that was one of the aspects of the film that I loved. These internal struggles within the civil rights movement played out across this film, you know, and it played out across the civil rights movement from the, you know, early 50s all the way through to the 70s. So we have the, you know, Dr. Martin Luther King representing the SCLC, or the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, predominantly Southern Black Baptist clergymen. So reasonably conservative folk within the civil rights movement. You have John Lewis representing the SNCC, or the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, you know, tertiary students, young people, obviously far more radical in what they want to achieve and what they want to and how they want to go about it. But also you have the NAACP, that, you know, the, as I said before, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, a biracial movement, one that's had a long history within the civil rights movement dating back to the early 1900s, and how they want to go about it. And watching this struggle with all of these organizations, and you also basically the forerunner to what eventually would become Malcolm X and the Black Panthers in that room as well. So just this tension and this argument, and poor old Rustin is stuck in the middle of it, because not only is there a disagreement about what should be their strategic goal and how they should go about it, there's also then this second tension, which is you are openly gay and we do not want you a part of this. So there's this tension, which I think is, you know, really, really sad. But not only are they trying to stop the eradication of Jim Crow, and that this this movement is based on equality and civil rights and social justice, but they won't afford it to Rustin because of his sexual orientation. And also what adds to it is that, so they've got, they, you know, these people who are fighting for equal rights, there's a blind spot because they don't want him to be a part of it. But it turns out that he actually is the best person for this role, but they still don't want him to do it, and they'll do whatever they can to undermine him. And essentially that is the story of this film and the story of Rustin.
Yeah, I think it takes a really good look at how difficult it is to create change and how complicated it is, and specifically for the civil rights movement, just the weight of what they were doing and the huge hurdles that they had to overcome. And, yeah, a lot of them were mostly internal, you know, specific to the march. But I thought it did a really good job at looking at all of the ways in which, you know, particular campaigns or particular issues can, you know, they can fail because, you know, there's not a clear strategy or everyone is not working to the same goal. So I think a lot of politically minded people, a lot of political organizers, union organizers would find this very relatable, this film.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the same thing I thought when I was watching it as well, and knowing that you and I are about to do this show, I was like, oh, well, you know, Tessa's background's with the trade union movement as well. She's been in these rooms where people were sitting arguing about how to do this, right? So you mentioned, you named before about the tension between, are there any women going to come into these meetings? The other one that was interesting, I thought, was the struggle over the strategy between particularly the NAACP represented by Chris Rock's character and that of the organizing community, because the NAACP were the people that paid for the lawyers to go and take to the Supreme Court the what became Brown versus the Board of Education, a case that was a landmark historic case in the United States that said that segregating children in schools is unconstitutional. And on that basis, then that opened up the floodgates to then identify where segregation existed in the South and how to overturn it. But the NAACP wanted to continue to do this through a legal strategy, a legal framework or a legal theory of change, whereas organizers on the ground were like, no, fuck that. Like, we don't want to keep on just empowering lawyers to go to take this to the Supreme Court. We can get change through other means. And one of them is to pressure politicians within the Democratic Party to create legislative change. And so this March on Washington is a way of showing our collective strength and our power and then putting pressure on the Kennedys, in particular, obviously JFK was the president at the time, to say you need to create legislative change. And so we saw this strategic tension between the NAACP and Rustin as a representative of the organizer in the room, and seeing how he can pull together those other mighty forces that also wanted to go down this pathway. And that, as an organizer and also as a nerd of this movement, that was a moment of the story that I loved. Then I turned to my partner, I went, this happened in Montgomery as well. And kind of looked at me as if, like, I don't know what you're talking about. But, you know, that was a significant moment in the story. For those of you who have an interest in this history, I think that would have jumped out for you as well. I don't know if I get too carried away with myself, Tess, here. But anyway, that was something I loved out of the story too. Any other reflections about the plot before we talk about the strengths and the weaknesses of it as a piece of cinematic work?
No, I think you have it covered. It was quite a deep dive into a moment in history. There was a lot to learn throughout the film, but the central plot we've got covered, I think.
Excellent. Okay, let's talk about the strengths to start with. I thought, and I think you named it as well beforehand, the performance by Colman Domingo I just thought was amazing. I just gravitated to him. I thought he did a great service in his portrayal of the work of community organizers and the chaos that comes with the work and how he built relationships with the people that he was working with, how he brought people together, how he was so charismatic, how he was led by his values and not by his ideology. But he also wasn't perfect. He had his faults. He got carried away. And I thought the portrayal by Domingo was excellent. That was one of the – I thought he actually carried the film, to be honest with you. I thought that it was the greatest strength.
I agree. I think without his performance, it may have fallen a little flat because it was quite dense in the topics that it covered. And I think he really did carry the film.
Yeah. Now, there are other things I did like about it, but I'm going to put it in the other bits section that we tend to do. And I want to now go to the weaknesses. And I consciously, when I wrote all this out for myself, I thought, God, I've got more weak spots than strong points, but I actually overall loved the film. But here are the ones that I thought were weak. There was a lot of cast members and they kind of came at you at rapid fire. And I thought there could have been some sort of device that could have helped the viewer better get a sense of who exactly we are meeting in the film, because these characters were super, super important. And at times it felt like, you know, you'd rocked up to a family reunion of your partners and you can't remember everyone's names. You go, who the hell was that? Was that Uncle Joe? You know, like, there was just so many characters coming at you. And I think that to give this plot the gravitas, we needed to understand, because we were basically in the epicenter of the civil rights movement's Hall of Fame right there.
It's funny that you say that that's a weakness, because I really liked that about the film. I liked that just kind of glossed over the giants of the movement in the film. But I am also a Google as I go movie watcher. So it's made for people who want to look at, you know, two screens at the same time, because I was just having a ball on Wikipedia, looking up who everyone was, making sure I got them right, and then, you know, watching the film at the same time. So it's interesting that you found that a weakness. The cast was huge, but that wasn't an issue for me.
Well, then I wondered, were there characters in the film that were underused? That was a second weakness for me. Like, we really...
But the film's about Rustin.
It is, and I'm not suggesting that we wanted to learn more about, you know, Martin Luther King. We've done that. We've had Selma, you know. We all know who he is. And I just kind of, like, Chris Rock appears and then we kind of don't see him again for hours later. And I'm like, well, why did you bring Chris? Like, I get it. Ray Wilkins plays that role. But I just thought, for example, I thought Chris I thought Chris, sorry, Roy Wilkins. I thought Chris Rock was very underutilized. I thought Philip Randolph was also very much underutilized. He was such an important character, and there were important scenes that were in the film, but it was just kind of like, you're trying to bite off more than you can chew.
Yeah. I would agree with that.
Think about the time you've got, right, to land this story. I'm sure it would have been hard for the editors to work out what to keep and what to lose. I don't know. I just sort of.
Yeah, I wonder whether they made a much larger film and then edited a lot out. Because I do think you're right. There might have been some gaps there.
Yeah. And there's some scenes where you could go, I could just do without. The on again, off again relationship with Tom.
That went on a little bit. Although some parts of those were very powerful without giving any spoilers.
Yeah.
I think some of those scenes were some of the most emotional for me.
Yeah.
In the film.
Yeah. Okay. And my last one is, it's not a tearjerker. You know, I thought it failed to really target the heartstrings in that kind of, you know, films like Selma or In the Name of the Father, films about seeking justice. There's always that moment where you are just either angry with rage and upset, or you're just absolutely, you know, malodin at what's happened, or just breaking your heart. And it never happened. And I just thought that there's sadness in this story, and it just didn't come through.
Yeah, I think one of the weaknesses for me is I thought when we got to the march itself, that was a bit rushed. That, you know, here was the key thing that everyone had been working towards. They got there, you know, I think it might still be one of the largest marches, you know, in US history. And it sort of fell flat at the end, cinematically, emotionally for me. I thought there would be this huge sort of build up and sort of, a huge display of emotion. But the march itself wasn't particularly the most powerful part of the film.
And from the actual march, the addresses on the steps in front of the Lincoln Memorial, we got literally one clip from the speech by Dr. King. And it was actually probably arguably not one of the most famous lines out of the speech, right? And I was kind of like, and that's it, we're done. Oh, we're out. Okay, right.
Yeah, and then it was over.
Yeah, they're packing
it up. And
Russell
was picking up the trash.
Yeah.
So it's almost like they had all this stuff at the beginning, and then it's like, we've got to finish the film, and it rushed. That was the only, you know, weakness I found.
Yeah.
In the film. And, you know, I guess maybe they did interject some real footage. I think that looked to me like real footage.
Yep, they did.
And maybe that sort of, I don't know, took away from it a little bit, sort of took you out of the moment of the film.
Yeah.
Because it's so obvious when it's switching between old footage and what they had filmed. But, yeah, the ending sort of lost it a bit for me.
Let's take a quick break to talk about SwiftVox. Every moment on a campaign matters. You need the tools that you can trust. Lists that are up to date, absolutely. Phone banks that can change minds, emails that drive donations, and events that will energize the community online and offline, and text blasts that distill your message perfectly. SwiftVox CRM is made for campaigners by campaigners. And to find out more, go to swiftvoxcrm.com to win your next campaign. Okay, let's get back to the show. Any other weaknesses that you saw before we move on to the other bits?
No, that was it.
Okay, so the other bits I've got, here's one thing that's interesting. I Have a Dream speech is not the name of the speech. Do you know the name of the speech that Martin Luther King gave on that day?
No, I don't. Can you just tell me?
It's called The Fierce Urgency of Now.
Oh.
And, in fact, if anyone has done public narrative training, in particular the story of Now, we use this particular speech to talk about a great example of combining both hurt and hope and then creating this urgency that we need to act. And that's why the speech is called The Fierce Urgency of Now. He does use that phrase in the speech itself, but obviously we all famously know it's I Have a Dream. Rustin was posthumously awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom by Obama in 2013. Actually, this is more trivia than anything. The music soundtrack, I love the music soundtrack. It has a jazz score, and obviously jazz, an American, you know, modern American form of art, so synonymous with the civil rights movement, plays throughout it. A lot of this jazz is actually new jazz has been written, and there's some old stuff in there as well. But I thought the music was great. I thought it really set the scene. A lot of it's set in New York, has a real New York vibe to it, some stuff in DC as well. But, you know, broadly it had this New York vibe about it, and you can't do that without jazz. And I love that. I thought that was fantastic. And the other thing that I loved was the fashion. Any film that's set in the late 50s, early 60s in America is going to bring that great, you know, 60s, early 60s vibe. It's got this very ivy design, you know, the Oxford, long sleeve Oxford button downs, the rep ties, the jackets. And, you know, that was the style of particularly a lot of civil rights leaders in those days, because they wanted to present themselves as well-dressed activists to try and counter this narrative by those in the South that, you know, all of these black activists were just barbarians. And so they wanted to look cool. So they basically dressed very Ivy League. And in fact, there's a book I should recommend for folks if you like that kind of stuff called Black Ivy that actually details all of the kind of clothes that the civil rights activists wore, as well as a lot of the jazz musicians as well. So I love the kind of I love the costumes of it. It was very, very, very cool. Do you have anything that you want to add to that, Tess?
I'll look at the locations for me really were great. I thought some of the shots in DC were beautiful. When Rustin is having that conversation with the police about organizing the march, and the Lincoln Monument is behind him, and they seem so small compared to it. The locations were great, and the music was great. There's some Otis Redding in there, who is my favorite. So I think you nailed it.
Very good. Favorite lines. My favorite lines were, which is right at the start, actually. He says, "On the day that I was born black, I was also born homosexual. They either believe in freedom or justice for all, or they do not." That quote kind of sets the scene. And another sort of favorite moment of the film, I guess, is early. There's a quote about the unconstitutionality of segregation, and then it slides through this sort of slow motion montage of these sort of instantly recognizable chapters within the civil rights movement leading up to this moment, including Ruby Bridges, who was the young student who was being guarded by the National Guard as she walks into her school. You know, the first black student to be integrated in Louisiana, Elizabeth Eckford being berated on her way to class in 1957, all these white students screaming at her. The other one was Anne Moody, who was sort of this stoic civil rights activist at a sit-in in a diner as food's being thrown at her and all these white protesters are screaming at her. And sort of setting the scene before we begin this journey is to remind folks about what had gone before to get to here. And I thought it was a very moving, touching moment, which I loved a lot.
That was my favorite quote too, the one about you know, on the day I was born. I teared up in that scene. I thought that was very, very powerful.
Yeah, and probably a close second was actually when Martin Luther King went on TV to
defend him.
Yeah,
that was great.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, I guess at the end of it, for me, the personal story, as much as I loved all the organizing, all the like strategy stuff, it was really the personal story of Rustin that made me enjoy the film so much, I think.
Agreed. Last question, which is obviously, who are the social democrats in the show? I mean, obviously it's a political campaign type movie. But one person I actually wanted to highlight was actually that when I did a bit of research, Tom Kahn, who I mentioned before, actually started the Social Democratic Party of the United States. He started out as a socialist, but then became vehemently anti-communist in his student activist days, and then sort of obviously played a role within the civil rights movement, but then went on to do a lot of work within the labor movement, within the trade union movement. And essentially, really, if you read about his politics, he is an interesting character, but also he is a true social democrat, because there's always questions about folks within the Democratic Party. Some of them are probably a bit too right wing for us here in the Labor mm-hmm. Party in Australia, with their lack of, I guess I'd say, influenced by the trade union movement within their party as opposed to the Australian Labor Party. But Tom Carr would fit quite comfortably in the ALP, and someone worth reading about. Tragically,
that is so fascinating. I feel like this film is you in a nutshell. DC, New York, organizing. It just ticks all of the boxes.
It really did. It really did. And it just kind of snuck up on my radar. Someone said to me, "Oh, Steve, you should watch this film. You might like it." I was like, "Oh, yeah, I'll look at it on a Sunday night and had some pizza." And I, by the end of the film, I was like, going, "Oh, this film's great. Really like this film a lot." Anyway, so I thoroughly enjoyed it. I don't know if we do ratings. I can't remember. We probably ask the same question every 12 months. But my recommendation is watch it, particularly if you're, you know, hell, everyone listens to this podcast as a solid citizen and definitely comes from a campaign background. So, yes, I think you should watch it. You'll love it.
I'd recommend it too.
Wonderful. Okay. Very good. And I only mentioned that in 40 minutes. Gee, Stephen, really dragged that out. Tess, over to you. Let's lighten the mood a bit. Tell us what you watched and you want to recommend for us.
Okay. I mean, you would have had to have been living under a rock to not know about this film. It was the biggest movie of the year. It is Barbie. It brought in $1.36 billion at the global box office. It is now Warner Brothers' highest grossing film of all time, taking over from Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2.
Wow.
It was directed by Greta Gerwig, who did Lady Bird and the latest Little Women remake. And it stars Australia's own Margot Robbie as stereotypical Barbie and Ryan Gosling as Ken. I think most people I know have seen it. If they haven't seen it, they have heard about it. It was the biggest film of the year. And I will try to explain some of the plotline without giving away too much.
Right.
So stereotypical Barbie, played by Margot Robbie, lives in Barbieland, an amazing feminist utopia where all the Barbies run the show. They're the president, they're Nobel Prize winners, they're astronauts, doctors, physicists, lawyers. They're all carefree women full of self-confidence and self-love. They have their own dream houses, incredible wardrobes, perfect love heart-shaped waffles each morning. And it's all perfect. They do dance routines. Kens are off on the side somewhere, not a central part of it at all. And it's all hunky-dory until stereotypical Barbie has a thought about death, which she isn't meant to. And then all of a sudden cellulite appears on her thigh, which is not meant to happen to Barbies either because Barbies have perfect bodies. These are all things Barbie has never experienced. And Barbie realizes that this is caused by whoever owns her and is playing with her in the real world being unhappy or sad. So to go back to her former perfect cellulite-free self, she needs to go into the real world from Barbie land, find the girl who's playing with her that's unhappy and make her stop being unhappy. Barbie lands in the real world, finds out that women and girls do not hold up Barbie as a feminist icon and hero, and basically she just discovers what all women across the globe know: catcalling, misogyny, sexism. And Ken comes with Barbie as well and discovers that the patriarchy exists in the real world. And so the adventure continues as Barbie tries to find her owner and get back to Barbie land and back to her stereotypical self. I'm really excited to talk to you about this, Stephen, because I have not talked to another a man about this film. So I'm very interested to see what you thought. Did you like it?
I did. I really enjoyed it. In fact, I haven't seen Oppenheimer. I prioritised Barbie over Oppenheimer. I don't know what that says about me. but I just I was really curious as to how do you make a film about a child's doll and turn it into something that is basically becoming a pop culture sensation. And I kind of got it when I went and saw it. I thought it was really, really good. I know we're going to go into sort of breaking it down, but broadly speaking, I just thought it was a very tight film. I thought it had a beautiful message. I thought it was very, very well constructed. It looked amazing. Like you couldn't look away from the TV. Really, really, really enjoyed it. I thought it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I mean, that's the first time I've had to explain the plot to anyone. So it sounds bonkers, and it is, but it all kind of works. And I mean, the central characters there are obviously stereotypical Barbie, who's Margot Robbie, Ken, who's Ryan, played by Ryan Gosling. There's Weird Barbie, a Barbie who's been played with too much. Who's played by Kate McKinnon from Saturday Night Live. The Mattel CEO is played by Will Ferrell. Barbie's owner, I guess, is played by America Ferrera. The Barbie creator herself, Ruth Handel, is played by Rhea Perlman. And there's a little cameo there. Do you know who narrated the film, Stephen?
Oh, now you're testing me.
Like a classic English female voice.
I've forgotten. Who was it?
It was Helen Mirren.
Oh, that's right. It was too.
So she narrates parts of the film, mostly the beginning, which was a real highlight of the film. And then there are many, many, many Barbies. So many Barbies. And so many Kens. Issa Rae, Dua Lipa, John Cena is a Ken. Simu Liu is a Ken. Were there any cameo highlights that you...
It's a massive cast. And it's a pretty heavy-hitting cast as well, I think. Mm. And that's what I... That impressed me to, like, you know, fair props to Greta for being able to run around Hollywood and say, hi, making a film about a child's doll. Really want you to be in the show because, you know, if you're the agent for some of these actors, you'd be thinking, what is this all about? Has there ever been a film made about Barbie before, like, and not landed, just been...
No, I think this is the first one.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, I think she's done a great job in getting all of these big names to put their name to this film because it kind of made it in some ways, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, because it had someone for everyone. A lot of the cast of Sex Education were Barbies and Kens too. I can't believe how many famous people. The budget for this film must have been absolutely huge.
If there was only some sort of device that could tell us what the budget was. Hang on. While you're talking, I'm going to find exactly what the budget is.
Would
you say gross? 1.44 million, right? So
1.36, I think.
Ah, right. So 1.4 billion was the box office at this point. The budget was 145 million.
Wow.
It has made
wow.
Bank.
They ran out of pink paint producing this.
That does not.
Because they painted so many of the sets, like the world was short of pink paint to try and get this film up and running.
The sets are amazing. I mean, you can't, if you're going to make this work right, you can't stuff up the sets because that's part of the whole Barbie thing, right? It's just that all the accessories that come with Barbie. That was one of the things that I really was interested in when I was watching. I was going to, how are they going to set this up in Barbie world? And I thought the sets were fantastic, but that doesn't surprise me that they used up all the pink paint.
really, the highlight for me was bringing the humor element along with talking about serious issues, about the patriarchy, about gender equality, and melding them together in an amazingly pink, beautiful, and fun, hilarious satire. It was amazing because too often I think we're we have to choose, you know. You've either got to watch the trashy rom-com or you have to watch the heavy drama and, you know, pick. And this kind of just melded it all together, which was a real, real strength for me. What about you?
Yeah, well, I mean, this was the controversial part, wasn't it? There was elements within the, certainly, I don't know if it played out too much in Australian commentary, but maybe Sky After Dark, but certainly in the United States, in a lot of the right-wing media, they were all, that it was like, oh, here we go, Hollywood's at it again, trying to teach us lessons we don't need to hear, blah, 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 blah. And I was like, oh, for fuck's sake, like just watch the film and just acknowledge that, you know, all in this world isn't exactly Skittles and rainbows for the opposite sex, you know, and just enjoy the piece of art that it is. But no, there had to be all these big issues about it. I just thought it was a bit ridiculous. But yeah, no, it was very, very clever. That's probably the best way I could describe the film. It's a very clever film.
Would you have taken a child to see it?
I would take a teenager to see it, definitely.
Yeah.
I think it would go over, I mean, I don't know, maybe 10-year-olds in 2023 are smarter than a 10-year-old when I was 10. But it would have went over my head as a 10-year-old. But I think as a teenager, I think it's actually probably a great film to take them to. I don't know. Would you?
It's kind of hard. I think a lot of it would obviously go way past them. But I think it still has those great messages about equality and what the patriarchy means for women, and what it can be like, you know, if we work together and stick together. So it's, I think there are still good messages in there, but probably not for kids. Too long too, and maybe a little bit too boring.
Well, particularly for this generation, you can't seem to watch a film without looking at 30 other different screens as well. But I reckon that you don't think that they – would this be a film that could hold a teenager's attention? Did it hold your attention? Like did you find yourself – you weren't Googling Barbie, were you, during watching it though, right?
No, I wasn't. I was in a cinema full of women watching it. So I wasn't Googling as I was going, and I guess because I didn't need to, because they were all things that I was very familiar with. But I have lost my train of thought. What was the question?
Did it hold your attention, basically?
Oh, it did hold my attention the whole way through. Do you know the only part where I dipped out for a little bit was the very famous Ken scene? The I'm Just Ken song moment.
Yep.
I thought went on for a little long. I liked the beginning and I liked the end, but in the middle I sort of dipped out. What were your thoughts on Ryan Gosling's I'm Just Ken hit?
I love Ryan Gosling. He's mm-hmm. I can't say enough about the man. I think he's fantastic in everything that he does. But the I'm not a musical kind of film goer anyway. Like if I see songs break out, I'm like, really? Do we have to do this? I just like, and I hate when films sneak in musicals without me knowing, because otherwise I wouldn't have went and seen it. true story. Almost went and saw Hamilton until someone told me, oh no, the whole thing's a musical. I was like, oh right, okay.
Are you saying you haven't seen Hamilton?
No, never. I just couldn't do it.
You would like it, but
it's a musical. You don't know how much I hate them. Just don't sing to me, you know. Just don't sing to me. So yes, I'm with you. It annoyed me. I just didn't. I was like, you know, like, and all the spin-offs. There's been spin-offs like in SNL. They did one recently when what's his name, who used to be on SNL, went back on the show. They did a piss take of the Ken song. I was like, it just didn't do it for me. I'm not a musical guy, so I didn't like that. Having said that, though, I thought he was great. Loved it. In fact, my favorite quote, which we'll get to later, is actually a Ryan Gosling quote.
Very interesting. Well, yes. So the extensive Ken Ballard was a weakness for me. And I think this isn't actually the film itself, so I'm not sure if it's fair to criticise, but the marketing campaign in the lead up to Barbie seemed to really grind on everyone's gears. Everyone was doing it, donuts, toys, everything was Barbie themed before the film was even released. And I think that turned a lot of people off the film, even from the get-go. So I'm hoping that people still went, I mean, obviously people still went to the cinemas and saw it. But I think for some people that really was off-putting, the whole marketing shebang.
It worked though, right? Because everyone rocked up. You could tell who was going to a Barbie film, going to watch Barbie that night, because they were basically decked head to toe in pink.
Yeah. So that everyone was proven wrong, which was great.
Yeah.
The music, a moment for the music.
Yeah.
It was the music in the film was all produced by Mark Ronson, so I'm not surprised that it was amazing. And he wrote the I'm Just Ken songs. On the soundtrack, you've got Lizzo, Dua Lipa, Billie Eilish, the Indigo Girls. I didn't know who the Indigo Girls were before this film, did you?
No. I'm looking at the
list. You still don't know who they are?
No. I don't know who, actually, I'm really showing my age here now because I've going to struggle to know who. I mean, some of their names look familiar, but if you'd ask me to tell me what they wrote, I wouldn't have a clue.
It's very now, very yeah. Hip now soundtrack. I was listening to it for months afterwards.
Did you think that Barbie Girl by Aqua was going to get used in the film?
They did sort of a revamp of it at the end.
Was that in the credits?
But, yeah, in the credits.
Yeah.
But it wasn't in the actual film.
That disappointed me.
I'm sorry, Stephen.
I know. I was really looking
forward
to it.
Surprising, given you don't like musicals.
I just wanted it to be dropped in there at some point. Like, even if it was a funny nod to it, like, you know, like even a bit of a piss take, I would have been there. Yeah, that's great. Love that. Apparently it's due to bad relations between Mattel and MCA Records, who engaged in a series of lawsuits over the song from 1997 all the way through to 2002. So Mattel weren't pleased that Aqua had actually even written a song called Barbie Girl, period.
Can you believe that Mattel was allowed or they allowed them to produce this? They were producers. So, you know, Margot Robbie and Greta Gerwig had to get everything ticked off by Mattel.
Yeah, absolutely. I do wonder that I don't know the backstory of this. Perhaps you can tell me, Tess, but is Barbie as a product struggling and it needed a revamp and this is where it came from? Or did it come from Greta actually thinking, no, this is actually the story I want to tell? And I now need to go to Mattel and say, hey, can you sort me out here with the rights?
Look, I think it's a bit of both because a Barbie script has been being shopped around for a while. In fact, Amy Schumer was going to play Barbie, but in sort of a completely different iteration of the film. Mm-hmm. But Barbies have definitely been on the decline. So this is a huge win for Mattel in terms of sales and bringing Barbies back in into play. But I was just really surprised that Mattel, I mean, because throughout the film they make some very strong points about capitalism and consumerism and body image for women and how women, you know, how Barbie's made women feel about their bodies, you know, really unrealistic expectations. But I just, it was a progressive move by Mattel, which really surprised me. And they took the piss of Mattel as well. Like Will Ferrell's the CEO and it's an all-male boardroom. And when Barbie comes to the real world and she gets to this Mattel headquarters and she's like, oh, while I'm here, can I meet your CEO? And Will Ferrell goes, it's me. And she's like, oh, what about your CFO? And the man next to him in a suit says, oh, that's me. And she's like, no women work here. And that was a great scene in the film.
The ensuing chase, though, afterwards, kind of, that was one of the weak parts of the film for me. I was like, I didn't get this sort of hijinks running through mazes of the office, running past each other. What, it was kind of a bit caricaturey.
It was very caricaturey.
Yeah. I mean, is that meant to be kind of like that's what you would do with Barbie dolls or something? I just didn't understand why that was happening. I don't help me out there. It was almost like a Benny Hill chase kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there weren't any other chases throughout the film. So this was it, was this Barbie's attempt to do the blockbuster high-speed chase and build a bit of tension. I think there's been quite a lot of criticism that the last sort of half of Barbie is the weaker half that maybe didn't really make sense. Like at the beginning when you land in Barbie land, it's all hilarious. You know, she's drinking her morning juice and nothing's coming out, but it's all still wonderful. And then towards the end, it sort of kind of gets a little bit more bonkers, to be honest, and doesn't make all that much sense.
Yeah. And that's, you know, I don't know if we're ready to do what you thought were some of the weaknesses of it. Are you ready to do that right now? Because that is the weakness for me. I just thought that it went a little too long. I remember saying to who I was watching it with, I said, okay, let's wrap it up now. I've got the point. We can end this now. And it kind of had another 15, maybe 20 minutes, and I just sort of – like the actual final scene was great. That was lovely. She goes in and I think she's back in the real world, isn't she? Yeah, that's great. Keep that. Mm-hmm. But everything in between was just kind of, okay, we're done. Are we done? Well, I think we're done now. We've nailed this, right? Let's just.
I think that's the modern movie now, isn't it? Couldn't they all be half an hour shorter?
Yeah, exactly, right? When's that going to come back? I'd kill for that.
I would love just an hour 15 movie.
Oh, particularly that's given the dream. By the time I start, if I'm going to watch something at home, like after I've finished doing all the other shit I've got to do, I don't start watching a movie till 9 and then you look how long it is and you're just like, oh, my God, I'm not going to get to bed till midnight on a school night. That's just impossible.
Did you have any other weaknesses?
Just no. The length, the singing, no aqua. And Kate McKinnon's character, I don't know.
Undecided. I thought she was hilarious. This is an interesting question for you because when I watched Barbie with my boyfriend, I had to explain to him, like he had never played with a Barbie. He didn't have any sisters. He didn't know that her feet didn't, you know, touch the ground, that they were always pointed.
Yep.
And a lot of the physical acting in it, so, you know, Weird Barbie is often in the splits and she has her hair, you know, shaved or cut or manically. And, you know, for women, it's like, oh, yeah, I had a Barbie like that. I think I had Brenda from 90210 Barbie and we cut all her hair off and, like, Sharpie marked all over, you know, tattoos all over her body, which is what Kate McKinnon's character is. But I think for some people who don't know what Barbies are, that would have just, they would have completely missed that element of the film. Did you grow up with Barbies?
No, I didn't. But I had cousins that did. Mm-hmm. And I still distinctly remember sitting down with one of my cousins, and she said, like, okay, we're going to play Barbies. And I said, okay, no worries. Now, I'm not unfamiliar with the concept of playing with dolls. Like, you know, if you're into Star Wars, you know, the whole Star Wars toy thing was based on basically miniature dolls. They're figurines, right? So it's not like, so I know Han Solo and Luke Skywalker and all the dolls and all the little figurines that came with it. So when I started playing with Barbie, I sort of picked up the first one and said, what's her name? And she said, Barbie. And I went, great. And then I picked up another one. What's her name? She said, Barbie. No, that can't be right. And I picked up the bloke. Oh, what's his name? Ken. Great. Picked up another Ken. What's his name? Ken. They can't all be called Ken and Barbie. And I just couldn't understand it. I couldn't get my head around it because, you know, what kind of world is where they've all got the same name? And so I just kind of chucked it in, got up and walked away. So that was the extent. But I certainly, you know, held one in my hand long enough to know that, yes, the feet, And the whole, you know, the body language and that kind of stuff. But I wasn't really aware of the – it also had to be explained to me, the freaked out Barbie. What was it called? Messed up Barbie? What was it? What was Kate's?
Weird Barbie.
Weird Barbie. Because I guess girls, you know, just get bored and start cutting chunks of hair out of Barbie. Is that right? Is that what happens?
Yeah, set them on fire, all sorts of things.
Did you play with Barbies? That's the question that's
I did. We had a lot of the 90210 Barbies. I had a Barbie caravan. No, I wasn't hugely obsessed.
Favorite Barbie that you had?
It was fun. The Jenny Garth's character from 90210, we had her. What's her name? I've forgotten. She was blonde and beautiful.
Brenda
was Shannon Doherty's Canada character.
Jenny Garth's character was she dated Steve.
I've got the song singing in my head. Well, she dated Brandon, didn't she?
Yeah, but she was dating Steve at the start when they first arrived from Minnesota.
Kelly,
very good.
Kelly Barbie.
Yep.
I did that without Googling. All right, I'm conscious of time. So we touched on music, sets, costumes were incredible. Any other bits you wanted to mention?
No, I guess just sort of the things that happened around it as well, the stuff that came with the show, I thought that was really interesting. Like just a lot of, you know, the memes, the rivalry between Oppenheimer and Barbie, and that meme I saw where there was this pink explosion in the distance. I don't know if you saw that one.
I just saw everyone making themselves into, you know, because you know how that I'm lawyer Barbie, I'm astronaut Barbie, and then, you know, people were like, I'm Ozempic Barbie, and like putting them, you know, I'm single mother Barbie. I saw all of those ones and enjoyed it very much.
And obviously this year's Halloween was very much dominated in terms of the costumes by either Barbie or Oppenheimer. So it clearly really made such an impact outside of just being a film, which you got to, you know, give props to, right?
Yeah, it was the film of the year. It really exploded everywhere.
We haven't talked too much about the characters, but just the casting of Margot Robbie as Barbie. Is there a more perfect person to cast as the main Barbie? What Barbie was she? Traditional Barbie.
Stereotypical Barbie.
Stereotypical Barbie. I mean, is there anyone else you could have cast that would fit or would be better than Margot Robbie?
No, she is perfect. No notes. And in fact, the film mentions that, you know, as well. It kind of, Helen Mirren comes in with her narration and says, you know, if you want Barbie to be real and more realistic, maybe you shouldn't have cast Margot Robbie as this. When Barbie starts to sort of lose her stereotypical Barbie beauty, because Margot Robbie is absolutely stunning. I thought she just was perfectly cast, and I sort of similar to Rustin, I think had she not played Barbie, it would not have been successful.
That's a great point, actually.
Sorry to cut you off, but had she not produced it as well? So, you know, she was a producer along, you know, and also the star character. So she had a lot more control over her character, and I thought, you know, that was really important to the film because it could have been a real mess.
Yeah. Oh, one other thing. Yeah. What are we doing next? Because I just want to get your thoughts on the whole Chinese South China Sea controversy. Did you pick up on that?
Oh my gosh, no. Tell me about it, please.
So it's called the Nine Dash Line controversy. Obviously, there's a dispute in the South China Sea between a whole bunch of countries in that area. And the controversy was over the alleged appearance of the Nine Dash Line, a depiction of the South China Sea from Chinese perspective in the film. Which began when Vietnam's censorship authority banned the film for allegedly displaying such lines. In contrast to the Philippine counterpart instead requested the lines in question be blurred, and both countries have banned the films for including this actual nine dash line. So it's this disputed border between China, right. Vietnam, Taiwan, Malaysia, Brunei, the Philippines, and it was in there. And apparently the Chinese lost their shit about it.
Wow. I had no idea.
That's crazy. Biden doesn't need that right now. He's trying to make friends with them again, and this happens.
It's all Barbie's fault. Why did Barbies get blamed for everything?
I know. Who knew?
Which is also another key part of the film. All right. Favorite lines.
All right. You go first. I've got one. It's just the one that made me absolutely piss myself out aloud.
There were two really standout lines for me where I sort of teared up. You know America Ferrera's big speech about how hard it is to be a woman. That really struck a chord with women across the world. I didn't find that that engaging, which was, I don't know, surprising to me. But I did tear up at towards the end of the film, and the Ruth Handel, who's played by Rhea Perlman, the creator of Barbie, she says to Margot Robbie's stereotypical Barbie, "We mothers stand still so our daughters can look back to see how far they have come." And I found that to be really powerful. I don't know, I'm one of three girls, and a lot of women in my family and extended family, so that meant a lot to me. And also that scene where Barbie's in the real world and she, for the first time, sees an old woman, because in Barbie land there are no old women, they're all young. And she just turns to her and says, Barbie says to the old woman, "Oh, you're so beautiful." And the old woman turns back to her and says, "I know it," and smiles. And it was just a beautiful moment, I think. They were the top lines for me. What about you?
Well, I'm going to bring it down a notch because I'm just going to come up with one of the lines, which is by Ryan Gosling, which is towards the end when he says, "To be honest, when I found out the patriarchy wasn't about horses, I lost interest." And I want that on a t-shirt.
Classic. Classic line.
It's just the horses thing was
you
just
should put it on a t-shirt.
Well, the horses thing throughout it was just bizarre. When he went to the library, came out with all the stuff, and it just like sort of set the tone.
With the books.
The books.
And it was all from seeing the police on horses.
Yeah. And then he said, "Oh, to be honest, when I found out that the patriarchy wasn't about horses, I lost interest," which was great. I loved it. That was my favorite quote.
Who are the social democrats in the show? I mean, everyone in Barbie Land is a social democrat, right? They have a democratically elected president. They have free healthcare, free food, I would imagine. They don't really want for anything. They have fabulous wardrobes. So is either everyone in Barbie a social democrat or no one at all?
I
because
think
Barbie herself.
If there
is
isn't,
just
they should lobby to have social democrat Barbie. I don't know what she would wear, but I feel like it would be sort of hand-me-down jeans. I bet you there might have been a hippie Barbie they brought out in the 60s, right? How long's Barbie been around for? Longer than that.
Oh, ages. Since the 50s. Yeah, that was another highlight in the film, was when they sort of flashed up on the screen all the, you know, archival outfits.
Yeah.
You know, from the 70s, like flower power Barbie.
Yeah, exactly. I think you're right. Barbie's a social democrat.
All right. Any last thoughts on Barbie?
No, go see it if you haven't already, which I would find hard to believe that you haven't seen it. Hence why I think it was okay that we can kind of give away some of the not critical spoilers, but let's be honest, pretty much everyone's gone and seen Barbie, yeah?
Yes. And if you're a man, please go see Barbie. If you're a man who hasn't seen it, go see it.
Okay. And did you paint your...
That's my recommendation with a caveat.
Did you paint your... it's hard to tell because the camera's a little bit foggy, but do you have pink, what do you call it? Fingernails? Have you painted your nails?
No, I have red. I have red nails today.
They look pink on the picture. All right. Very good. Thank you, Tess. Good job.
Sorry.
Let's now move to part three, which is Tessa's other summer recommendations. Da-da-da. And you're going to rip through some of them and we're going to talk about them. Over to you. What are your recommendations for folks to watch whilst at the beach?
So if you are looking for things to watch, there are two of my favourite TV shows of the year. The first is Deadlock. It is an Australian dramedy. It is based in a really small town in Tasmania where a dead body washes up and it's a murder mystery. It is hilarious, so unexpected, Australian. I love it. Have you seen it, Stephen?
No, I haven't actually. I've heard a little bit about it, I think. It's not scary.
It's hilarious.
Though, is it?
No.
Not that I'm worried about scary films.
Cool. It's a comedy.
Oh, right. Okay, good. Yes. What channel is it on?
It is on Prime.
Prime. Very good. So, yes, I can't contribute to that one, I'm sorry, but I've heard good things.
The other one is Morning Wars, which is on Apple TV. Jennifer Aniston, the host of America's morning show, very popular morning show, and she gets a new host, which is Reese Witherspoon's character, Bradley Jackson. There are three seasons, and this year they released the third season. And you've watched Morning Wars?
I have. I finished it.
Because I loved it. I was obsessed. It's like glossy trash, but I loved it so much. Basically, it's like a lowbrow version of The Newsroom, which was done by Aaron Sorkin, which I also really loved. So it's obviously it's a fictional story, but they talk about real news events, you know, a lot of the Me Too movement, COVID, the pandemic, going into lockdown, and then, the riots on the Capitol Hill building. It really captures everything. What are your thoughts on the Morning Wars?
I'm glad you said it was trashy because I also liked it and I kept on asking myself every time I watched an episode, why do I like this show? Because it's not that good, but I couldn't stop watching it for some reason. And I don't know whether it was escapism or whether there was nothing else on, but I finished it. I watched all three seasons. I don't like any of the characters at all. Or maybe I like a couple, which we can talk about in a moment. But broadly speaking, like the main character, Jennifer Aniston's character, Alex Levy, can't stand her. Absolutely can't stand her. Have no sympathy for her whatsoever. I think she's selfish, self-centered, narcissist, shit at her job, makes dumb decisions. Yet I couldn't stop watching and I don't know why.
I think because it's done very well to tap into news, current events, and it is very glossy and it just keeps you on the edge of your seat. And I agree with you. I don't really like any of the characters either. But it has a great supporting cast. You've got...
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you. Were there characters you did like? Because I was thinking, is it just me? Am I just a grumpy bastard or?
I tell you what character I enjoyed, who I didn't think I would, was Billy Crudup's character. And he's the head of like the network. Yep. And he's unhinged and he's so weird and I loved his character so much. I thought Billy Crudup was a really likable character, even though he's the big network boss, horrible man. He's very likable, I think.
So I 100% agree as well. Like also terrible human being, shit-ass boss to his workers, but there was something about him that I kind of like was attracted to him. Going, why am I liking Billy Crudup in this film, in this TV series? Because you're not a good person at all. But I couldn't help if I was rooting for someone in this show for some reason. I was rooting for Billy Crudup, and that goes against every value in my body. But I loved it. I don't know. Maybe it's just the way he acts. I do like Billy Crudup in shows anyway. I've always been a bit of a fan of his, but I just found him to be enjoyable. And I reckon if Billy Cobb, if they wrote him out, I don't think I continue to watch the show.
Oh, that's a big call, but I would, that's a big call, but I agree. He really drives, I mean, a lot of the plotline, really, and he is very, very entertaining. But if you're not in it for Jennifer Aniston or Reese Witherspoon or Billy Crudup, John Hamm was in the latest season of Mad Men fame. Who else was in it? Juliana Margulies of The Good Wife was in it. It's star-studded. It's actually the perfect summer watching. It dips into the dark at times, but it keeps you drawn in inexplicably, it would seem, for you and I.
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting as well, because, and maybe we'll talk about it in a moment, but I think also because, yeah, actually, now I want to think this through, because it's loosely based on NBC, but it's kind of like based on all of the major networks in the US, NBC, ABC, CBS, right? But, and the challenges they're facing, this mainstream multimedia networks and how they remain relevant and all of that kind of stuff. So that is an interesting topic to consider as well. But it's also interesting at the same time as whilst Succession is going on, because they're both two drama series about media. But one is actually about inside the media house, whereas the other one is more about the kind of playing with the media. And just the juxtaposition I found quite kind of interesting. This is kind of like media light as opposed to media heavy, which would be Succession. Anyway, so I enjoyed it from that perspective. And bringing in John Hamm kind of freshened it up in the third season, and the fact that they were basing it on what was happening in our lives. Me Too movement the first season, bit of Me Too, and then moving into COVID in the second season, and then coming out of COVID and then into January 6 in the third season. There's a relevancy to it that makes you go, oh, I actually wouldn't mind seeing what they think of something that is incredibly contemporary in our lives. And I thought they did an okay job of creating a story that ran through these moments in real history.
Yeah, I'm the same. I really loved that element to it. I don't know about you, but I love watching stuff about the pandemic, even if it's not real, even if it's fiction. I find it just so fascinating because the whole world was going through it, right? But I was stuck in my apartment in Collingwood. So I know some people just want to put it away and not think about it ever again, but I actually really like watching entertainment that sort of that covers it. So it was great.
Yeah, and how it's interpreted.
So that's my second recommendation?
The different perspectives, how it's interpreted. That's sort of, you know, I think that's fascinating. I'm with you on that one. Okay, great. So second recommendation, what's next?
Succession. I mean, anyone who loves it has already seen it. If anyone who hasn't started Succession, they should start it this summer and watch it, I think. Did you like the final season, Stephen?
I did, but I reckon they could have actually laid an absolute turd and I probably still would have watched it. I was so goddamn invested in the whole thing that I just needed to get towards the end, regardless of how good, you know, the episodes leading up to it. And I remember finding myself at the end of every episode saying to myself, okay, am I still watching this just because I need to know who wins, or as a standalone piece of drama, is this episode up to scratch? And I kind of made a spreadsheet about it, but I wasn't that far away from making a spreadsheet about it. I found that the final season, broadly speaking, was good drama because of, and I won't give a spoiler, but because of what happened in episode 3, because I was like, holy fuck, I did not see that coming. And right, you've brought in something pretty significant early, whereas in the previous seasons, it just slowly built up to this big crescendo in the final episode where you go, oh my God, that's amazing. I can't wait for the next season. Whereas this one, they kind of turned it upside down. They threw a bit of a spanner in the works, which just set yourself up for going, where is this going for the remainder of the season? I just thought the final season actually was really, really good, really outstanding.
Yeah, I don't know why people were so critical of it. I thought it was incredible. Kept me on the edge of my seat. I thought the acting was amazing. I thought Sarah Snook's performance throughout the season was so good. I won't go on too much about Succession because there are too many spoilers to give away, and we've talked about it on the show before. But I do want to ask you, the ending, the final ending of Succession, did you pick it? Did you call it? Did you know it was going to end that way?
I did, but late. Like, I reckon maybe two – I need to go back and watch it, but I would say, like, this the second or third last episode, I thought, I think this is where it's going. And I said it out loud, so I didn't look like one of those wankers that, you know, Monday quarterbacks. I actually said, I think this is the direction it's going, and it did in the end. But it took me a while. What about you?
Yeah, because I asked you that because I wanted to be on public record that I picked it from like season one, from the beginning.
Oh, wow.
That is how it would end in that particular way.
Oh, wow. Okay, that's really fascinating. And that's so annoying that we're not doing spoilers, because now I want to ask you, what were the things that gave you that insight? Because that is huge. That is absolutely huge, Tess. And bravo to you for doing that. Maybe we're
thank you so much.
We're going to have to catch up and have a beer and debrief that at another time.
We should.
Excellent. Are there any others on your list, or are we done?
I will add one more to the list. It's a doco series. It's called Colleen Rooney, The Real Wagatha Story. It is a hilarious but also serious documentary about two Premier League wags, so Colleen Rooney, wife of Wayne Rooney, who plays for Man U, and Rebecca Vardy, who's Jamie Vardy's wife. And there was this whole Instagram scandal about who was leaking to the Sun newspaper, and it is a great watch. I couldn't pull myself away from it. That one is on Disney Plus. Great summer watch too.
I've heard about this. I've not watched this. What other shows are you going to watch over the summer break though? Because there's a whole bunch of new stuff coming out, including The Crown. I don't know if you ever watched that, but I feel, even though I'm a staunch Republican, as we all are, I've kind of enjoyed it. I mean, have we talked about The Crown previously? Maybe not. But I'm just going to finish it. It's one of those shows I'm like,
I don't think so.
I just want to get it done.
I lost interest about two seasons ago.
And
it started to be about real sort of alive, like more, yeah, it's not for me.
Well, maybe we have talked about it. I feel like I said to you, I cracked the shits too when slow. They completely glossed over what was going on in Northern Ireland, because I was waiting for them to come to what happened.
Have talked about The Crown.
Yeah, the bloody Sunday. And they ignored it. And I was like, you literally covered an avalanche in the south of Wales, and that was a whole episode, and you can't cover the murder of 14 innocent civilians at a civil rights march in Derry. Like, come on, this is meant to be on British soil, in air quotes. And they just skipped over and I cracked the shits for a while. But anyway, I've kept on watching for some reason, so maybe I'm the fool. Anyway, Tess, thank you so much for doing this again. I certainly hope all of those folks that are listening to today's episode that you got something out of it and you got some things to watch over the summer break. It's been thoroughly enjoyable, and I actually think I'm going to get back and watch Barbie again just to recheck some of your notes from today's unpacking of that wonderful film.
Thanks for having me, Stephen. This has been a fun chat, and happy holidays, everyone.
Indeed. Happy Hanukkah, Merry Christmas, and have a happy new year in the coming days. Thanks for listening to Socially Democratic. Did you like the podcast? Hit the follow or subscribe button and be sure to leave a review on Apple Podcast or Podchaser. And to get all the latest on Socially Democratic, follow Dun Street on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. And we'll see you next Friday. Today's episode of Socially Democratic was brought to you by Maurice Blackburn Lawyers. Maurice Blackburn lawyers have spent more than a century paving the hard path to justice for everyday Australians, and they've helped over 500,000 Australians turn their situation around, and they know how the system works. Their experience and skills means that you'll get the best results possible. To find out more, go to their website, morrisblackburn.com.au. Maurice Blackburn, experience you can count on. Social Democratic was brought to you by SwiftFox. Every moment on a campaign matters. You need the tools that you can trust, lists that are up to date, phone banks that can change minds, emails that drive donations, events that will energise the community online and offline, and text blasts that distill your message perfectly. SwiftFox CRM is made for campaigners by campaigners. To find out more, go to swiftfoxcrm.com to win your next campaign.